Good evening and welcome to the London School of Economics. I am Vesna Bojčić-Djelilović, Associate Fellow with the Research Unit on Southeast Europe here at LSE, which is organizer of this evening's event. It is a pleasure for me to serve as a moderator for the public debate on current developments in Bosnia and Herzegovina, inspired by the book called Vision 2020, Bosnia and Herzegovina Towards Its European Future, edited by Sasha Toperic, Heidi Obermeyer, and Tea Ivanovic. Over the years, here at LSE, we have hosted a number of debates on Bosnia-Herzegovina, and I think it's fair to say that we have covered almost every phase on its trajectory towards reconstruction and peace building. And I can still vividly remember a lively debate we had here with Mr. Paddy Ashdown, a former high representative in Bosnia and Herzegovina, over the jobs and justice agenda that had started under his term in office. And at that time, I remember there was a very strong argument that Bosnia-Herzegovina was finally coming out of a post-conflict phase and entering into a European integration phase, which was supposed to reorientate policy priorities towards improving political and social welfare outcomes for the population of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Looking back, much of the excitement, hope, and expectations around each of those potential junctures has proved somewhat exaggerated, I would say, in that overall a genuine breakthrough has failed to materialize. And this seems to be one of the premises of this book, against which the argument is made that Bosnia-Herzegovina may just be again at quite a crucial turning point. The contributors in this book engaged with economic reforms in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the context of the British-German initiative around the Compact for Growth and Jobs. And I can say that in that respect, this debate is quite special and fresh, because in the past, we tended to spend a lot of time talking about the political and security concerns, not that the two can necessarily be separately discussed. But nevertheless, the book really foregrounds the issues of the current reform efforts. And I think the book is hopeful and forward-looking, which is reflected in its title, conveys a possibility that the momentum behind the latest effort at the comprehensive socioeconomic reforms may have a catalyzing effect in breaking the status quo. And you will hear how and why in a moment. And I think the timing of the debate is significant. As the book Optimism contrasts the assessment we have heard rather recently from various corners that the country might again become a theater of turmoil and even possibly might be falling apart. What is particularly valuable about this book is that the contributors are a mix of local and international academics, activists, and practitioners, which provide a rich account of challenges of economic reforms and possible openings for the mobilization of local resources towards more effective and sustained reform process. And I think there are some novel themes, or if you like, novel areas that are explored in the context of economic reform, such as the potential of information and communication technologies, the role of tourism, etc. And I'm sure we'll hear some of that in the presentation. So let me now introduce our speakers in the order in which they will be speaking. First, we will have Mr. Sasha Toperic, who is a senior fellow and Mediterranean Basin Initiative Director at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Paul Nitzsche School of Advanced International Studies of the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. He's also the president of the America-Bosnia Foundation, president of the World Youth Leadership Network, a business consultant to a number of companies worldwide. He is co-editor of the book on Iraqi Kurdistan region, A Path Forward, just coming out in 2017, the book that I have just mentioned, and several other books. In 2003, he was an advisor to the ambassador of Bosnia and Herzegovina to the United Nations. From 2003 to 2007, he was a special envoy of the presidency of Bosnia and Herzegovina to the United States. And in 2009 and 2010, he served as a counselor at the permanent mission of Bosnia and Herzegovina to the United Nations. And if I may add, a rather famous pianist. I mean, that is not in his official biography. Our next speaker is Mr. Adnan Muminović, who serves as a political economic advisor to the EU Special Representative in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Prior to that post, he interned at the German Bundestag in Berlin and Heinrich Böll Foundation in Washington, D.C., and worked as a political advisor at the Norwegian Embassy in Sarajevo. Mr. Muminović currently works as a teaching assistant in macroeconomics at the School of Economics and Business in Sarajevo. He holds a BA in economics and MA in European studies from the University of Sarajevo. And next to me is Professor Michael Pugh, an emeritus professor at the University of Bradford, visiting professor at Nijmegen University, if I pronounce that correctly.
Well, it's actually finished now, so.
Okay, but it's still in your bio.
You don't have to pronounce it.
Good, if I did it wrong. And honorary professor at the University of St. Andrews. He was born in Middlesex towards the end of the Second World War. His early university education was in New Zealand, but was the first PhD in English and American Studies at the University of East Anglia. He subsequently lectured at the universities of Southampton and Plymouth. His research areas include critical security studies with an emphasis on the political economy of peace formation, peacekeeping, humanitarianism, and the UN. His regional focus is the Balkans, where he conducts field research. He has frequently presented at conferences and is regularly consulted on peace-related issues. Professor Pugh will give us his assessment of the key issues of socioeconomic reforms in Bosnia, and we are very glad to have him here with us, having made the trip all the way from Plymouth. So please join me in welcoming our speakers tonight. I will now turn to Mr. Toperic to tell us a little bit about the project, its objectives, and you know what you would like to see come out of tonight's debate. Please.
Thank you. Is this working? All right. I guess it's not a big. Vesna, thank you so much, and thank you for such a splendid introduction. You made my job quite easy and brilliant. I want to thank the all of you for coming tonight, and particularly LSC for organizing this event. And first and foremost, to Aleksandra Stankova, who I've been in touch for about 7-8 months. We thought of Aleksandra. I just acknowledged you. Thank you so much for. For a great effort. We thought of making more events on social economic reforms, and I'll, in a half a minute, explain why not. But I think it's very appropriate that we are here today in London, as Vesna suggests, after a decade, it's even more than a decade of a stall in Bosnia-Herzegovina due to several failed attempts to mend the constitution. It was through the British and German initiative that actually the socio-economic reforms were launched, endorsed by the old governments in Bosnia-Herzegovina and the entire international community. We may have disputes over transatlantic and the international community, also inside the Bosnia-Herzegovina itself, if such an effort may actually be successful, given the complexity of Dayton Peace Accord, the country that has about 12 governments and 154 ministers and 12 parliaments, a country that has less than 4 million people. But leave that argument aside, I think... Oh, thank you. I think what is important, I think, is about the book itself, is a testament to time. It's a testament to a period where actually the governments in Bosnia and Herzegovina did come together. And this is a major success, I think, for the British foreign policy, German foreign policy, and dare to say, maybe first and foremost, of a spirit within the country itself, for the youth, for the people, that people can work together. And honestly, in a 1 year of time that we at SAIS observed support and helped Bosnia and Herzegovina in various form and shape, they did synchronize legislations, the entities, government, state-level government. They found a common ground in trying to create a better conditions for the life of their citizens, unfortunately. And then, as you know, they passed the labor law, they passed various measures, and we can say that the beginning of a social economic reform was a successful. As it unfortunately happens, the reforms are in a stalemate at this point in time. And this event, apart from the book that I appreciate Professor Zvezna's kind comment, does elaborate and does nail down the achievements made with the suggestions of what needs to be done more, how the country should move forward in the context of a social economic reform. It is also important that through this event, when we send this to people in Bosnia and Herzegovina, we do remind the leaders and the people of that country that they need to continue. The only way forward to make a country more stable, let alone prosperous, is through this reform agenda agreed by the entire world. Now, I look forward to listening to our panelists. Thanks for the great intro of my life. I've been last decade on a different side of the Atlantic, and as an American, I've and also Bosnian, but I work from a center that actually is, not to brag, but number one affiliated think tank in the university in Washington, D.C., and we do have a great people who do care about the Balkans still, and the message we'll send also to our friends in Bosnia and Herzegovina, time is running out and people can't be overly patient with the slow pace of what's done. So I look forward to hearing your questions. I look forward to understanding more of this great university people here and our panelists of where you think now that we're entering in a certain second uncertain phase to where these reforms are going. And I'm very happy we have a young Bosnian here who works from the European Union, and it's the future of the country indeed. And I think there will be certain things do take time, and as Vesna said, our mutual very dear friend, Lord Ashdown, always during his tenure at the High Representative, which was marked as one of the most significant and excellent period in a post-war Bosnia-Herzegovina reconstruction, would always address the youth and the importance of the youth. This complexity of these issues won't fade away, not in this debate, not in any foreseeable future, but it's a step forward, and I thank you all for coming, and I look forward to talking to you later on, and again, thank LC and everyone here for coming and organizing this event. Thank you so much.
Sasha. Adnan, please.
I hope this is working.
Yeah,
Thank you all very much. Thanks to LSE for hosting this event tonight. Thank you for coming and for showing interest in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Sasha, big thanks to you also for publishing the book. I know what tremendous amount of effort has gone into it, way beyond normal working hours, and what you have invested also privately in it. At the danger of repeating some of the things that have already been said, I'd like to outline a little bit the history of the region and how it exactly came about, what we have achieved so far, why we currently have a stalemate, and how we see things progressing in the future. And for, I think the publication of the book really gave us, who were contributing to it, a good opportunity to pause, to reflect and consider what we have achieved over the last 2 years, ever since the reform agenda started. And really, one important aspect, the reform agenda has already accomplished part of its purpose. For the first time, we're actually talking about socio-economic reforms in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which has not always been the case. And I'm pretty sure if it wasn't for the reform agenda, we would be here tonight, certainly not me, but someone else would be here tonight talking in one way or another about Dayton. And this is not to say that Dayton should not be talked about. It's not to say that Dayton is great. By all means, it is not. It doesn't say that it should not be changed. At one stage, it will have to be changed. As a matter of fact, and this is important to bear in mind, no country has ever joined the European Union without having to amend its constitution, and the BiH will have to do the same, if it leads to implement the Sejdić-Finci ruling, not to mention anything else. But it took, unfortunately, a lot of time for people to acknowledge the fact that the society and the politicians were still not ready for this change. And it's not that you would think that there are groups of people who are happy with Dayton. I don't think that anyone is really happy with Dayton. It's just the fact that any opening of the Dayton, a certain group or groups feel that they might lose something during this process. And until we have acknowledged this, we have lost precious time. So even before the reform agenda, there were ideas of changing the approach to Bosnia and Herzegovina and focus on some other things. But these ideas never materialized until one breaking point. And it was always, might sound like a bit of a romanticized narrative of how things evolved, but the 2014 protests were really the threshold where many things changed. And this is where we found out how big the frustration of the people was with the state of the economy. And if you add to this the 2014 floods, which added to the agony, there was just a sense that something had to be changed. And really, at that time, there was a lot of soul-searching on part of everybody, and also, especially, on part of the international community. It became clear that by insisting on constitutional changes, insisting on legal changes, the international community had completely, for years, neglected what happened to the lives of the vast majority of citizens in the country. And I was really so fortunate to follow this whole evolution because I started working as an intern in the European Union in November 2013. And I remember when I started, Sejdić-Finci was the issue of the hour. And I remember politicians from Bosnia visiting Brussels often, then visiting Prague. Former Commissioner Fuhle coming numerous times to Bosnia and Herzegovina, to bring always some new models of how the Sejdić-Finci ruling could be solved. We never actually got there. And then you had the switch, and ever since we are primarily focused and talking about socio-economic reform. So the part of this new German-British initiative, which became the EU approach, was not to say constitutional legal matters, especially Sejdić-Finci from a human rights perspective, are not important. We all know how important they are. But it was about resequencing this. Doing socio-economic reforms first, and then once things are relaxed, and if people's lives improve, if they find better jobs, if they get higher salaries, if the fight against corruption is more successful, if social assistance becomes better targeted, that you would have a more relaxed atmosphere in the country that would allow you to talk about all these other issues that plague the country. And it was really in my office in Sarajevo. I have a quote by a Montenegrin artist who's my unlikely hero of the reform agenda. He has no clue about the reform agenda, basically, but he gave a very interesting interview a few years ago describing the situation on the Balkans. And this is sort of what he said. Nationalism is a topic for people who make 300 euros a month. Those are the ones who are being served this story. Once you start making 500 euros a month, you start talking about nice cafes that opened up in the city and about clothes and so on. If you're so lucky to earn 1,000 euro a month, you know, you talk about organic food, a healthy lifestyle, half marathons, and where it's better to go skiing. Is it Olympic Mountain Bialystok, Olympic Mountain Jahorina? And if you're so lucky to earn 3,000 euros a month, which is a distant dream, unfortunately, in my country, then all of these topics stop and the only things you talk about are love and philosophy. And this sums up sort of what I personally also believe the reform agenda is about. You know, it's just creating a better life for citizens and then, you know, in a more relaxed environment, let's talk about all the other issues. So just to give you an idea of how things evolved. I mentioned the February protests and the May floods. Already in December 2014, the Foreign Affairs Council of the European Union adopted its conclusions on Bosnia and Herzegovina, saying that meaningful progress on socio-economic reforms will be necessary for the country's membership application to be considered. Now you might, you know, ask yourself, what does meaningful progress mean? And this term was left out intentionally vague. It was ultimately a political decision, but one that was well-founded in what has actually happened in the meantime. We were talking then about socio-economic reforms for months. The European Union, together with the international financial institutions and the United States, identified an initial paper of ideas and fields which needed to be tackled. And this is the so-called Compact for Growth that was mentioned before. Then the new governments came in place at the end of the year. Negotiations lasted, and we finally, in mid-July 2015, had the reform agenda as a document basically consisting of 6 pages, which went through 13 different rounds of negotiations and which focuses on the following 6 fields in Bosnia. Public finances and taxation, basically less public employment and public spending, you know, and switch the economy towards the private sector, improving the business environment. You know, BIH is one, unfortunately, of the countries in Europe which has the poorest business environment. Third was the labor market, trying to make it more flexible. Fourth was social policy and pension reform, trying to make the whole system much fairer. Rule of law, the fifth, and public administration was the sixth. So then in February 2016, the then chairman of the BIH Council of Presidency, Mr. Dragan Šović, submitted BIH's application. And we were then waiting to see meaningful progress on the reform agenda. In the meantime, the European Union started working closely with the international financial institutions, primarily with the IMF and the World Bank. And it was agreed, and this was one of the lessons learned, and there's a lot of mention on this also in the book. Previously, when you had these programs with the IMF and the World Bank, what the IMF and World Bank would do is give out money to the authorities and then ask for reforms. And then you can see that, unfortunately, many of these previous programs, especially standby arrangements, were unsuccessful because of that. This time around, it was agreed. First reforms, then comes the money. Even in the case of the IMF, the governments wanted not a standby arrangement, but an extended fund facility, which is even a more profound program for deep structural reforms. And the IMF said, okay, we're here. We are ready to provide 550 million euros in direct budget support for these reforms in addition to all the technical assistance. But this is the list of prior actions that you have to meet in order to have the program in the first place. And included in this prior action, as Sasha was mentioned, were the labor laws in both entities. We have talked about these labor laws for years, but they were never adopted. And this was actually proof that this conditionality in this case was working. And, for instance, in the RS, they had to liquidate 2 banks, which was definitely not politically popular and something easy to do, but which was nevertheless done, and ultimately in September sealed the IMF's extended fund facility that runs for 3 years and is a total of 550 million euros in direct budget support. On this occasion, the IMF also noted in its mission report that the reform agenda promises perhaps the most significant reorientation of BIH's economy since the time of Dayton. A few weeks after that, the European Commission took this ceiling of the IMF program as a sign that meaningful progress has been achieved and asked the European Commission to submit its opinion on BIS membership. A few months after that, in December last year, Commissioner Hahn submitted the questionnaire to the authorities consisting of 3,442 questions, which we are currently answering. From what I hear from my colleagues, 95% of these questions have been answered, and we hope to complete this process in a few months' time. So thus, thanks to a significant degree to progress under the reform agenda, BIH was back on its EU accession track after years of virtually no progress. Now, if you ask what has made the reform agenda to a certain point, and I'll come back to this in a while, so successful, first of all, there was a high sense of ownership when it comes to these socio-economic reforms. They were negotiated between the governments for months. And we had meetings where a particular sentence was negotiated for 2-3 hours. Usually the case in Bosnia before that has always been, you know, that we had imposed foreign solutions in the country. Well, this time around, the governments came with their own plans, said what they wanted to do. The IFIs were heavily involved there and said, okay, these reforms would warrant our financial support and these reforms would not. So this sense of ownership really played an important role in all of this. The second was this close coordination that we still have between the European Union and international financial institutions. And each of these institutions is responsible for one segment of the reform agenda, but in such a way that they all reinforce each other, that they're perfectly harmonized and to this extent also sequenced. And honestly, I also think that the February protest served as a wake-up call to the authorities as well, that the situation could not continue anymore like this, and they were much more focused on socio-economic reforms than they have ever been before. 2017 was supposed to be the key year for the reform agenda. This is where we hope to achieve the biggest progress, especially when it comes to public administration reform, health reform, and these reforms that usually take a lot of time. Why we thought it is because 2017 is a non-election year in Bosnia. As you know, we have local and general elections basically every 2 years, and it seems that we were, always in some sort of a pre-election campaign. We knew that at this time of the year, the window would soon start closing. Unfortunately, it closed already in April with the failure to adopt an increase in fuel excises. This is something I won't bother you right now, but if you have some questions about this, I'll gladly take them. But, you know, I think there's a tendency in life when things start going bad that you forget about everything good that has happened before. And I would not like this to happen with the reform agenda for the reasons that I outlined before. And what I want to say here is that there are, of course, things that are unique to Bosnia, which makes socio-economic reform so difficult. But really, in all the other sense, what we're experiencing in the country is nothing that any other country, developed democracy, Western democracy, has not developed when it started doing its socio-economic reforms. I mean, you have a huge literature in academia basically asking the question, you know, do reforms pay off? And do reformist governments get reelected? And the famous quote that comes to my mind when we talk about these things is the quote by the current president of the European Commission when he was Prime Minister of Luxembourg, who said, asked about socio-economic reforms, he said, "We all know what to do, we just don't know how to get reelected after we've done it." And a lot of, you know, these things play a role in Bosnian-Herzegovinian politics. And also, I mean, just two more things that are not unique to BIH that make reform so difficult. The first one comes, and I'll dwell a little bit into economic theory. I hope I won't bother you, but I'll finish soon enough. Comes from behavioral economics, and I'm very happy to see that Richard Thaler got the Nobel Prize for economics today. It's the notion that was not invented by him, but by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, called loss aversion. You know, that the psychological trauma of losses is probably twice as big of any gains, which basically tells you that the people who are losing out of reforms, even if they're just vested interests of a small privileged group, they, of course, tend to be louder and tend to oppose anything that is happening. And, you know, the paradox is the more successful these reforms are, the more resistance they face. And this is something that we already see in the case of our society. And the second point which makes reforms so difficult is, you know, the logic of collective action from Mansur Olsen, where basically this small privileged interest group is more likely to connect in order to make reforms difficult. So these are the basic points that plague every country. What makes Bosnia and Herzegovina particularly then complicated is we are very unfortunate to have different constellations of governments right now. We have a group of parties that is forming the RS government in the entity, and another group of parties that is forming the state-level government, and then they very often make life really hard for one another. But even in the federation, where you would think that these interests are aligned, they're not really aligned. Just coming back to this fuel excise issue, this is a very unpopular but necessary measure that needs to be adopted, that basically has to do with raising fuel prices in order to build highways. This is a state-level competency, but all the benefits from this particular reform flow into the entities, into the entity highway fund. So as a politician at the state level, parliamentarian at the state level, you ask yourself why you would like to support a measure which is highly unpopular, where you will never reap the benefits, you will never be acknowledged for having done these things. So this is something which makes these things particularly complicated. And also, I must admit, something that we had not thought about enough at the time of launching the reform agenda, and the failure basically and primarily comes from the authorities, but also on the part of the international communities. We have not succeeded in communicating reforms properly to the citizens. And we have not succeeded in adjusting expectations. This is exactly something that Vesta was talking about before. You know, the reform agenda, you know, people immediately expect that a life will become better, that they will get a new job, but structural reforms take many years to materialize, and we have failed, unfortunately, to communicate these things. So we have, we had a stalemate in the recent months, which is very unfortunate. And I just, at the end, want to provide you with some figures of what we managed to achieve so far. We've always been saying that it will take a lot of time until these reforms materialize. But we've already started in the last few months seeing some of these positive results. Just to give you a few figures, exports in March of this year were the highest in the post-war history of BIH. For the first 6 months, exports actually increased by 13% compared to the same period last year. Industrial production in August was up by 7% compared to the same period last year. Tax revenues, indirect and direct, are at record highs, which attests to the successful fight against the grey economy in the country. So much so that the Federation government recently cancelled 3 bond auctions, which is something that doesn't usually happen in Bosnia and Herzegovina, saying that they don't need to borrow the domestic market, that they have actually enough tax revenues to finance their budgets. And finally, we have different unemployment data in Bosnia, but the one that's really relevant is the labor force survey that we conduct only once a year. And this is in line with ILO methodology, according to the data last year, the unemployment rate was 25.4%. A few months ago, the data showed that the unemployment rate is down to 20.5%, a drop of 5%. Now, an unemployment rate of 20% sounds still horrible, and by all means, it still is. I mean, and other people would argue, rightfully so, that, you know, this drop has also to do with the shrinking of the labor force. The people are leaving the country, and that we have an aging society, which is all true. But some, at least 2% of this decrease are due to a new employment in the private sector. And this is something that gives us hope and you know, motivates us to remain on this path. A lot still remains to be done. What we were hoping to achieve this year is health sector reform, public administration reform, including, to use the euphemism, right-sizing. There will have to be people that will have to lose their jobs in the private public sector in order to free up resources in the public sector. And also SOE restructuring is a big thing that will come up in the future. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a very comprehensive and yet very succinct summary of what has happened and what this reform initiative has produced so far, and indeed the challenges, you know, taking it forward. So we now turn to Mike to see what is his take on what is going on.
Thank you very much indeed, Vesna. Thank you for inviting me and Welcome to everybody. Can you hear me all right? Is this working good? I have reservations, actually, about the whole process of externals trying to change the culture and identity of other peoples. It may, in fact, be easier to try to change the economic system, the political economy, but not necessarily the culture which has developed over many, many years. In order to look at this issue, I went back to a book that was published 12 years ago. And this was by Tim Donnay, and it looked quite extensively at all the problems that were occurring in relation to the internationals' involvement in the economy of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And he is, I think it's fair to say, a mainstream liberal. His critique, though, took aim at what he called neoliberalism. Now, of course, that term can be a term of abuse, a rhetorical term, but it is also useful as an analytical term. If you disaggregate what is meant by the process of neoliberalism and look at its history, and what he suggested was that the prescription of the donors and their priorities was deeply flawed. He noted that there was an inherent tension between relaxing regulation in order to make capital accumulation in the private sector easier and accompanying that with cheap labour. On the one hand, you had that attempt, and on the other hand, you had attempts to knit a shattered population together. And these two things did not connect. Of course, he pointed to the need to reduce crime and informal structures, to increase employment, to increase central government revenue, to develop an industrial strategy, which, as far as I know, does not exist, let alone an agricultural strategy, except export. BIH must make its own way through exports. But above all, he argued that neoliberal economic development neglects social consequences. And that, I think, was what spurred this reform initiative, which I welcome, because it's about time something was done to address this issue. It's interesting to note that one of the driving factors for this new initiative were riots and demonstrations that began in Tuzla, which is relatively multi-ethnic city, but has a long industrial tradition. Demonstrations because privatization of their workplace had failed. So these people were thrown out of work and had very limited means in which to survive. And I think one of the things we need to think about in this debate is the extent to which the sorts of reforms that are introduced into other countries reflect what is going on in the world economy. There is linkage. And my argument, in spite of the resistance that's shown by elites, is that elites, and in BIH's case, I think we can call them oligarchs, have actually manipulated with the external or international presence to make gains out of the neoliberal agenda. And what I will be arguing is that what has happened is that the political economy of BIH has been co-constituted. There's been a kind of intermestic meshing between the internationals who come with ideas about what an economy should look like and those who are attempting to get the most out of capital accumulation as a consequence of war and as a consequence of reforms. Because I think there's a danger that there is that people take a rather essentialist view of what Bosnians are like. And this is expressed to some extent in a new book by Jasmin Mujanović, in which he makes the following point. Societies in the Balkans are still largely defined by essentially primitive or pre-modern social orders. They have a feudal deference to elites. Now, there's more than a whiff of Orientalism about that statement, in my view. And I much prefer the sort of view that has been put forward by Mark Duffield in his book on the Never-Ending War, in which he looks generally at the interrelationship between the interveners and those who need assistance. And he talks about the social the security development nexus. The internationals have an imperative to secure the unstable parts of the world, partly because these instabilities may affect the stable parts of the world. And we can see this today with the refugee problem, for example. And he argues that there are opportunities to promote development strategies which sustains underdevelopment. Yugoslavia, as it was already closely integrated in the global economy. It had to be to pay off debts, to rebuild after the Second World War, and indeed to trade. So I think it's a mistake to suggest that integration with the international economy is a new thing for this part of the world. But what Mark Duffield suggests is that there is always a struggle between the domestic elites who control support in a country and the internationals who want to change things. The domestic elites want to change things in the way that suits them. But it's the masses that suffer both from the oligarchy and from the introduction of a social economic system that affects their social relations in adverse ways. So it can mean, for example, that the elites really like the idea of a suppressed workforce. They really approve of this flexible labour idea, Because it means that there is precarity in the labor force. And this is something that I've investigated quite separately from this. The whole idea that precarity, it has various aspects. There's an ontological aspect. We're all precarious because we're all uncertain about future. But there is also a precarity of status. People who don't have certainty about what sort of job they're going to get, whether they'll keep it, whether they'll be on 0 hours contracts, and so on. And that, I think, is really what the oligarchy in BIH is quite happy with, because it can control an informal labour market. It's also what the internationals advocate. And believe it or not, the International Labour Organization was one of the earliest international organizations to advocate what it called flexi-security. In other words, flexible labor. It had to adapt to a very fast-moving development in capitalism, not least through microchips and internet and so on and so forth. But it made this important condition. Flexible labor would work if there was social security of sufficient standing to make it easy for people to change jobs, to have short-term contracts, to go off for more education or training. And that is precisely what has not happened. The social security has been in the hands of oligarchs who control national communities. And I would argue that both the war and the introduction of neoliberal agendas has actually made things worse for the working classes than was their situation prior to the war. Just to illustrate the point that quite often an international engagement is not primarily for the people who work in that country, but in order to safeguard and secure those who are doing the intervening. I can point to an ethnographic survey by Steph Jensen in Manchester, who looked at the way in which the EU was determined that BIH should have secure, extremely well-regulated borders. And so cartographers were hired, people who were involved in customs, police were also involved in this process. Now, those involved had no particular faith in this idea of having more secure borders. And in fact, they realized that they were on a hiding to nothing, because they would build these structures and anybody who's tried to cross the border from BIH through to, say, Dubrovnik via Neum will realize what a difficult situation it is, with entire groups of people held up for ages trying to cross. But this process ticked every box that the EU set in terms of standards. And BIH comes out with top marks for border control. But these people who are engaged in it realized that if BIH joins the EU, they would be involved in dismantling these structures. So who were these borders for? Maybe to stop immigrants, refugees, drug trafficking, and so on and so forth, through to Western Europe. Now, strategic options, I think it is important that we look at various means to generate an economic boost. And several occurred to me. One, turn BIH into a glorified tax haven. In other words, the Jean-Claude Juncker solution from Luxembourg. And Thomas Piketty, who has, I think, a position that I've seen, made the following point. The prize for cynicism surely goes to Jean-Claude Juncker, who has been calmly explaining to a dumbstruck Europe that he had no choice but to siphon off his neighbours' tax bases. The manufacturing industry in Luxembourg was declining, so what could I do but become one of the worst tax havens on the planet? Well, it's not for me to advise BIH economists about tax avoidance. I'll leave that to the US and the UK governments because they have incredible expertise about tax havens. And there is now presumably room for more. All right, so I'll exclude that. But people have even mentioned it. And when I did research on municipal strategies, because I went around to municipal government buildings asking them what their 5-year plan was, they almost without exception, actually Tuzla was an exception, but almost without exception, they said tourism. Now, anybody who's been there can understand why. You've got medical tourism in Banja Luka, you've got religious tourism near Mostar, you've got war tourism, especially in Sarajevo, you've got adventure tourism all over the country. Terrific potential. The problem is that the hospitality industry is prone to corruption. It's prone to money laundering. Hotels are notorious. The Holiday Inn was one of the first. Not only that, but the people who work in that industry are poorly paid. And it may be seasonal. But they are part of the precariat. Nevertheless, I would like to see some investment, more investment, not just at high-end tourism, but tourism that develops on local initiatives, develops on local capabilities and expertise. Rafting down the Drina would be one of my favorites. There is also a free market in investment now. The Russians, to some extent the Chinese, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and so BIH is in a position to choose where it gets foreign investment from. And it's probably no coincidence that these initiatives from Western Europe have come about partly because Russia has shown an interest in investing in the area. And this brings me back to Mark Duffield's security development nexus. at the same time as these economic reforms are going on, there is pressure to join NATO and go beyond the Partnership for Peace. And there are Bosnians now with NATO forces in Afghanistan. The problem for the EU, of course, also lies outside Southeast Europe. Is there an appetite for expansion? Especially when some of the countries have a high Muslim population. Would it be easy to sell this expansion to the Western European, the EU populations? Is there a retreat from cosmopolitanism and a move towards protectionism and a move towards increased nationalism within Western Europe, not to mention the United States? A distinguished professor, Professor Buddy at Paul Tsai in Paris, told me a year ago that one of the great failings of the EU was to develop solidarity between politicians and corporations, but fail to develop solidarity between ordinary people. And I think there may be something in that. There is a great deal of educational exchange, and we, to some extent, as academics, are privileged because there is a great deal of solidarity amongst academics and special interest groups, but not among ordinary people, it seems. And then we've got the French, who want to have financial integration even stronger than it is now. And that can only be done, I believe, by having a two-speed Europe, which he has also mentioned. So you'd have members of the Eurozone, and I don't know whether Greece would be part of the core or part of the outer circle, the periphery. But my guess is that Southeast Europe certainly would be in the periphery of this, if it comes about, new development. I'll quote Thomas Piketty again, because I find him really quite interesting. He, incidentally, must have influenced Macron, because he argued in favour of greater federalism and greater integration at the financial level. He wrote an article which included the following point. In fact, the title was, "Being a small country has exorbitant costs." He says, "The costs of being a small country is becoming exorbitant. We find ourselves accepting things that are more and more unacceptable and contradictory to our values." One of the things he had in mind was the power of corporations to influence political bodies, to get special deals, to threaten to leave a country if they didn't get special deals, and so on. And the small country that Piketty had in mind was France. So what would it be like for BIH and other Southeast European countries? I'll come to an end very quickly. So I'm in favour of much more radical shifts, both externally and within Southeast Europe. A book on precarity by Isabel Laurie is really, really important. She argues that we need to pay attention to the structures that create hierarchies of power and gross inequalities and techniques of governance that sustain precarity. And I would argue that this agenda looks to me as though it is sustaining precarity. What could you do instead? Have far more progressive taxation. Don't increase VAT, which is being talked about in BIH, because salaries are so low, and as you know, it's the lower sectors of a working population that spends more on indirect taxes as a proportion of their income. Have a rentier tax, because one of the features of Southeast Europe is that rentierism has become so much more important than manufacturing. A land tax, a wealth tax, anything to get the political oligarchy to move to Delaware. You could have a species of Keynesian interventionism, at least some kind of pump priming that gets industry and agriculture and the things where people have jobs that create solidarities, have that moving. But above all, revive labour rights. The World Bank's current policy is to rebalance the economy away from labour power to the power of capital. Make the economic environment much more attractive for capital. Now, the trouble with this is that, and if we could see the slide, is that possible? Is that Labour doesn't have any power. Yep, that's fine. Yeah. I don't know if everybody can see it. Now, in contrast to the labour force survey, which has very strict criteria for deciding who is unemployed, and I thought it was only once every 5 years it came out, not once every year. The officially registered unemployment figure is what you see on the left-hand side there. And in, I think it was 2013, was one of the high points. 46% were registered as unemployed. Now, we can argue about these statistics because there are people who register for unemployment because it gives them health benefits. And maybe they're not unemployed at all. They're actually working in the grey economy. But there is also a significant group of people, perhaps up to 10%, who have given up looking but still register. The labour force survey, which has this lower figure, doesn't account for people who have given up looking because there are no jobs. It insists only on counting those people who are seeking work. And it has a methodology which involves household surveys rather than registrations, which may have their own problem. But above all, I think there needs to be an ideological change. Susan Woodward has just written this book in which she says that interventions fail because the ideology of intervention and its security development nexus, if you like, has an ideology which accords with the development of financial capitalism and the security of those who already have reasonable standards of living. So I'll stop there. Having been over provocative, I meant to restrain myself.
Thank you very much, Mike. I think it is good to be provocative. And on this last note on Susan Woodward's book on the whole concept of frail and fragile state being an ideology, one can say that on the economic front as well, the whole notion of transition is a form of ideology, because there isn't a model, there isn't a trajectory that is taking you to some promised land of employment, security, growth, and development. So we overrun a little bit by this contribution, so I'm eager to open floor for questions and comments. We have a mic around, and please introduce yourself and say who you're asking question. We have Daniela, and then we have a colleague here.
Hi, my name is Daniela Lai. I'm a LSE fellow at the Department of Methodology here. I have a question for Adnan. I have done research on the 2014 protests and talked to activists in Bosnia, and also talked to the communities where a lot of these activists came from. And it seems to me that I was wondering whether you think that the international community might have misunderstood part of the protesters' goals or grievances, in the sense that it seems to me that a lot of these grievances were partially caused or at least aggravated by some of the previous economic interventions in Bosnia, and that the reform agenda is not marking a sort of change in these reforms, but it's actually taking previous goals further with new reforms. And the other thing is that I appreciate that what you said about the international community trying to come closer to the actual concerns of citizens by addressing economic issues and social issues. And I was wondering whether the fact that the reform agenda was drafted with mostly in collaboration with governments and not a lot of input from citizens and the civil society led you to marginalize some important concerns for the people of Bosnia, say access to water, pollution and environmental issues, access to public spaces, and so on. So, yeah.
Thank you. Then we had a question over there, first row.
Yeah, Bernard Casey, ex of LSE. As an economist and as an historian as well, I am interested in the extent to which Bosnia and Herzegovina have managed to reintegrate themselves into the Balkan area. One talked about trade, and one talked about the importance of foreign trade and its contribution to growth. But how much does Bosnia and Herzegovina once again integrate with the area of which it is a part, and of which it used once upon a time to be a coherent part? Because my impression of that part of the world is one of increasing fragmentation. We talked about borders. There was some discussion about the recreation of borders and the creation of borders and the inability even of the area to act as an integrated economic unit seems to me one of the greatest tragedies. And so my question is, can one start there, or is one redirecting oneself completely outside of that area to somewhere else? And if so, what is one doing? Because it is not the sort of area where one would understand it to be a natural part of a European or an international supply chain, a production chain.
Thank you. Yes, one more. And then
Thank you.
John Yeom, I'm a teacher of politics who had the privilege of visiting Bosnia in 2008. It's over two decades since the Dayton Agreement, and I fear that the elephant in the room is the, frankly, somewhat unstable political environment, not to mention past nationalist baggage. So my fear is that the only people who will really be encouraged to invest in either part of Bosnia would be those with the ulterior motives that Michael Pugh was referring to. Thank you.
Thank you. And then, yes, so that the lady there with the glasses, and then that will be the first round, yeah.
Hi, my name is Petra. I am a master's student at the International History Department. I have two questions for each of the speakers. First, I would like to ask, Adnan, you talked about how it is very important that the reforms that are being introduced are, you said, owned by the Bosnian, you know, government and the Bosnian people. And I was wondering to what extent those most affected by reforms are taking part in that ownership. So the people who protested, you know, the people who actually triggered this new interest in economic reform, how much are they taking part in this ownership? For if I may just remind that one of the criticisms of Dayton is that it was negotiated between the national elites rather than having had any conversation with the people as such. And my second question is for Professor Pugh. So you talked about an open investment market with investments coming from Russia, China, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, as well as there needing to be an ideological change, and the EU getting involved as well after all these countries showing their own economic initiative. And I was wondering if you believe that economy is or could be a form of an ideological or geopolitical warfare in Bosnia. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, please.
On your, what was the first question? As Professor Pugh mentioned, the protests originated in Tuzla, which was really one of the most affected cities when it comes to failed privatization after the war, and this is where they originated and then spread to other parts of the country. And I think that one important lesson from this has been learned in terms, if you look at the reform agenda, except in one instance, there is no mention of privatization whatsoever. Knowing what it has done to the country and how politically sensitive, you know, I mean, rightfully so it is, there is only a sentence which talks about preparing plans to privatize BH Telecom, which is something that is overdue, and then, I mean, it should by all means be done. On your question about environmental issues and the reform agenda, unfortunately, doesn't tackle these and many other important ones. If you also read through it, you will see that there is basically no mention of education, which is also quite unbelievable. But I mean, the idea was, I mean, you could not do everything throughout it, except especially with education, which is so politically sensitive. The only thing we have there is linking the needs of the labor market better to education, and this is something, you know, rather still vague and with not too big of a detailed plan. And the former German foreign minister gave this Aspen speech in Berlin a few months ago and basically talked about the need of strengthening vocational training in the region, just something that is completely absent in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which actually go a long way into aligning the needs between the labor market and education. So, I mean, I'm afraid that you're right in the sense that many things that are left out, that were intentionally left out or left out because you did not expect to see huge protests in these areas in the 3 years that the reform agenda was running. On the citizens' involvement, before the reform agenda came about, there was this, I mentioned it already, Compact for Growth for Jobs, where you had, at least on side of the EU, where you had many consultations in Sarajevo, in Banja Luka, in Mostar. I mean, I know, you, and of course you can object to that, and you will always find people who will say that they have not been consulted. I mean, the thing that the EU did was, you know, establish an online platform that citizens could write, what bothers them. But I understand that these things tend to be sometimes more PR than anything substantial. So I definitely get that point. On your question, I think it was related to the citizens' involvement. The reform agenda, when you read it, really. First of all, it's not a work of a genius or geniuses. I mean, if you know anything about Bosnia or live in Bosnia, it has all the apparent issues that the country faces. And if you were to ask citizens if they favored this, and that, I think to a high degree you would hear the answer yes. The things that are in there are not really contentious. There is a broad consensus around these issues, like better targeting of social welfare. I mean, currently you have a situation where I think 70% of the social assistance goes to the 20th richest population in Bosnia. Only 36 go to the poorest 20%. I mean, this is not what social assistance should be. The reform agenda talks about targeting better social assistance, and, you know, and less current spending, current public spending, and more capital spending. These are the obvious things where you would have many people agreement. How exactly to achieve these things is exactly the debate that we have now about fuel excises, where, you know, if you ask, the Regional Cooperation Council has these surveys asking people, are you satisfied with the transport infrastructure? BIH has the worst response rate when it comes to transport infrastructure. More than half people say that the transport infrastructure is either very poor or poor. But if you ask them, do you want to increase fuel excises in order to build highways? This is where the consensus, unfortunately, stops. And to your question about regional trade, sir, a World Bank report from 2 years ago called Systemic Country Diagnostic, I think, says that if BIH were to reach its pre-war trade with its neighbors, its exports would actually triple. So we are far, far away from that, but the issue that you raised has actually been raised by the European Commission already. As you know, at the Trieste summit, there is this whole new idea about creating a regional economic area. There was an action plan adopted at Trieste which would tackle exactly these things to make the neighbors trade more. But in all of our cases, I mean, 7 out of 10 top exporting countries of BIH are EU member states, not really the neighboring. I mean, Croatia, and but not really the neighboring country. So a lot of this is already being done, but it will take some time until this is established.
Mike?
Thanks. All good questions. I think I'm right in saying that the only countries that BIH has a positive trade balance with are Kosovo and maybe Austria, surprisingly.
Also Germany, yeah.
Yeah. And to answer the question about interstate economic development, I think to some extent they're in competition with each other to be supply chain suppliers to places like Austria and Germany. One of the great problems, I think, is that there is very little value added in production in BIH. All the value added that occurs outside the country. That applies, for example, to timber exports. And if there is value added that's very low down the chain, car seats, for instance, and they all go to Volkswagen, and that's where the value added is, putting stuff together to make the final car. But in one case, there is very significant economic
integration, and that is in the supermarket field, which is rentierism, par excellence. And we've got the case now in Croatia where a company that's valued at approximately 60% of Croatia's GDP, Agricor, is in dire trouble. It has debts of billions, quite a lot of which is to Russian banks. It employs 20,000 people in Serbia and BIH. I'm not sure what the division between the two is. And it also owns a Slovenian supermarket, and in there Mercator employs 70,000. In Croatia proper, this company, Agricor, employs 40,000. So if that goes bust, and this is the kind of integration that has occurred, you'll find all the Mercator, Consum, I think Bingo is the only BIH supermarket in BIH. But otherwise, there is this level of retailing that goes on. Quite often, it's not domaci, it's not domestic produce that is sold in these Slovenian and Croatian supermarkets, but produce from those countries. On investors, again, very good question, but what is the attraction for investors in this part of the world, given that it can be regarded as unstable, not a proper country because it doesn't have a single government, and so on and so forth? All kinds of incentives for FDI, which was the great hope of the internationals, include ignoring environmental regulations or having lower environmental regulations than the EU, cheap labour, and there is no labour inspectorate, and because I did a pilot survey, I have some idea of the sort of tricks that employers get up to, right? Delaying payment, not paying at all, 2-month contracts, and these are in providers for car companies in Germany. So all kind of not paying the health insurance and so on. So there is an element of labour exploitation. The average wage in BIH today is 425 euros. But that includes public administrators who get at least double the average wage. It doesn't account for the fact that in the 7 years since December 2010, the increase in the average wage has only been 22 euros. The increase in pensions has only been 14 euros in 7 years. And, of course, inflation has occurred. The cost of electricity and water has gone up by 25% in the same period. The cost of bread has gone up by 15%, even though to us it seems ridiculously cheap, but there we are. And, yes, geopolitics. I think your implication is absolutely right. And, of course, it got a new twist with Putin's acquisition of the Crimea and the Ukraine crisis. But there is something odd. Ever since the internationals decided to engage in peace building,
The United States, which never had troops on the ground while the war was going on, didn't have peacekeepers or NATO troops, became interested. And I was told by somebody who works in the central bank that actually the conditionality on IMF loans is not as harsh as it could be. And he thought that that might be because the United States, which, you know, dominates these IFIs, may have had something to do with it, but he was only speculating. It has a huge embassy. There is often quite good political relations between US ambassadors and some of the party leaders, as there ought to be if you're an ambassador. But Philip Moon, the ambassador 2-3 ago, singled out two as commendable, one of whom got the push because he wasn't tough enough against the rioters in Sarajevo. He was Minister of Security. And the two politicians who were singled out were all in favour of these reforms, joining the EU and so on, and actually, you know, the bulldozer programme, the jobs and justice without either programme, and so on. So I think there is geopolitics going on. Very definitely needs to be factored into this.
I don't know if anybody else agrees.
Well, I think we'll have to very quick.
Oh, this can be quick.
Well, but it's 8 o'clock. We are at the end of it.
I really have to say like a lot of things, but it's important. I mean, it's important for people to hear. And I want to say those things. So if you can allow me 5 minutes, I'll take
Okay, five time. Minutes.
Okay, sure, thank you. So my name is Isnet Bharti Chanchara. I'm from Sarajevo. I'm studying a master's degree in international political economy at King's University. And also I'm a Chivani scholar, meaning I'm quite proud of the fact that I came here to learn. So, I mean, I don't have a question, because putting everything in one question would be too little. For example, I respect Adnan a lot because he came here and gave his perspective here, but personally, as a very young individual in Bosnia and Herzegovina, unfortunately, I don't see anything that has been done in the recent years as part of something that we should glow about and, you know, talk about. I mean, so just some of these questions. The social policy and pensions. The Bosnia and Herzegovina literally has the intergenerational solidarity pension, the Bismarck one, where generally by rules you should have one pensioner for 8 working people. In Bosnia, and I'm not so up to date with numbers,